I would love to dive in now to your role with Microsoft, because you say the word Microsoft, people must be going, wow, how did you land that job? What did you do? Chief Technology Officer is massive. So can you tell us how that journey came about and the steps that you took to get to where you are today?
Until I started at Microsoft, I hadn't done anything with technology. It's genuine. So I've had 8 years to learn technology. And I'm working with people who've been doing this for a lifetime, who have 20 to 30 years experience in this space. And that can be really daunting. I love that you talk about transferable skills. And I don't think we talk about this enough. In fact, I was talking about this with someone this morning who is seeking some mentorship. Oh, I want to change industries, but I don't have any skills. Oh, no, we all have skills. It's just we don't often know how to translate those into the terms that the industry we want to go into values. You will lose 100% of the jobs you don't apply for. If you're not in the race, you stand no chance at all. And if you think about all these other people who are throwing their hats in the ring and you're not taking that chance, then you'll never have that opportunity.
Sarah, welcome to the Career Confidence Podcast. I'm very excited to have you on. You've got quite the resume. You have been at Microsoft now for over 8 years, and you are the current CTO, Chief Technology Officer, across Australia and New Zealand. Now, I'm sure you don't get to that point by being average and by not sort of really setting yourself up for success. I'm really excited to have this conversation with you today. But can you take us back to the beginning of your career journey, how it all started? Did you always have a vision of what you wanted to achieve, or did things just sort of happen? Like, tell us about the journey so far. I'm excited to learn.
Thank you. It's always very humbling having people introduce you. I always feel like the phrase career journey implies that I did have some kind of idea of the destination. And mine is probably more of a career meander. I think at times I've had complete clarity on what it is that I actually wanted to do, interspersed with periods where I have absolutely no idea and I've just gone with the flow. And so I actually joined the army straight out of high school. I always wanted to fly helicopters, and I had this idealistic idea of what the army did and this role they were playing in peacekeeping. So I thought I was going to be flying helicopters in the service of peacekeeping missions. But unfortunately, 4 years after I started, I shattered my ankle, and I was given this choice of a desk job or getting out. And once you've dreamed of flying, a desk seems like the worst thing in the world. And so, of course, I opted to get out and realized ever since all I've done is desk jobs. But I felt really lost for a while, and I didn't know what to do. I felt unqualified to do anything. And I ended up in a law firm, started off as a secretary. And then I sort of found my way to different roles across that law firm. And that's become a bit of my modus operandi. I think of it as land and expand. So I've changed industry 3 or 4 times now. Probably more time, more roles than I could possibly count. And what I often do is I choose a job that I know I could do standing on my head. And I use that to then build a reputation off while I then work out what the next job might be for me at that company. Sounds very Machiavellian, but it's a pattern that's worked really well. And so, as I said, it worked for law across 3 different continents, telecommunications back in Australia, and then Microsoft.
Incredible. And I just want to say one thing that I just noticed when you were saying that journey is that for some people, and not all people, but they would have got out of the army and had that sort of moment, because I think a lot of people come out of that sort of institution being very much like, this is my identity, this is who I am. So the fact that you then were able to come out of that and get into law and do something completely different, which is just so incredible. So in those moments, because there's a lot of people that listen to this podcast that are a bit stuck, that are thinking about a career pivot or a career transition, but I can imagine you had a lot of skills from being in the army that you could then apply to law. And I always talk about transferable skills. So could you talk about how you went from being in the army to getting into law, and then again, getting into tech? Like, what has been some of those like pivotal moments when you look back, you go, oh, I did that because I did that, or that was a transferable skill?
I love that you talk about transferable skills, and I don't think we talk about this enough. In fact, I was talking about this with someone this morning who is seeking some mentorship, and they're like, oh, I want to change industries, but I don't have any skills. Oh, no, we all have skills. It's just we don't often know how to translate those into the terms that the industry we want to go into values. And I think maybe that's the piece that I've become really well practiced at, is understanding the language of a new industry, because the skills are the same. So the ability to understand a problem, to think through it, the military teaches you is this formulaic planning approach, which I do for everything in every job. What's the worst case scenario? What could go wrong? What's plan A, B, and C? And so that skill I learned in the army is the same thing I apply in every role and in every career move I make. And so, yeah, transferable skills for me is just about understanding the language of the industry you're going to, so you can translate what you can already do into the way they talk about it.
When you sort of mentioned that you're mentoring somebody, what I think sometimes that I'm going to sort of use women as an example of this is maybe it's not a skill, but it's not just a skill gap, it's also a confidence gap.
Yes.
I think that's something that women, we struggle with. Have you noticed that from your own, in your own career, from mentoring others? Have you always been quite confident, or how have you gone on that journey building your own sort of confidence as well?
Absolutely. And you're spot on. It is the number one thing I notice. And we've all heard the stats about how men will apply for jobs when they meet one of the criteria, and women need to meet 90% of the criteria before they'll apply. I think I was very fortunate in my upbringing when my parents told me I could do anything, and I took that quite literally. So I was like, cool, I will do anything. But I think, how do we help other women build that confidence? And so the thing I try and tell people that I'm mentoring or coaching is, you will lose 100% of the jobs you don't apply for. If you're not in the race, you stand no chance at all. And if you think about all these other people who are throwing their hats in the ring and you're not taking that chance, then you'll never have that opportunity. And so I try and encourage people to throw their hat in the ring, to take a chance. And the saying I have said all the time, what's the worst that could happen? Because it can be really confronting, like, oh, but I won't get the job. Great, that's the worst that can happen. But you might get an interview, and it might open a door. You might meet someone interesting. So what's the worst that can happen is my mantra for any of these things. So take a chance. What's the worst that can happen?
Yeah. And I think you and I definitely can relate to that as well. And I always think about regret a lot as well. And it's quite morbid, but I think to myself, like, what do you want to feel when you're on your deathbed? Which is quite an awful thing to think about. But I think death is our biggest teacher, and so many people are afraid of death, but actually I think it's here to push us and to make sure that we do live full lives. And I always think to myself, would I regret not doing this? And if the answer is yes, I do it. And I think that's something that a lot of people, if they thought about that, maybe they would just go for it. And who cares? Like, you know, really, I think that's the other thing. And I'd love to go into this as well, Sarah, because I see fear holds so many people back, but it's a lot of it, fear of judgment, fear of what other people will think. Have you, because again, it's like, again, I'm sure as you've transitioned careers, people said to you, oh, you've got it good. Why are you moving around? And you've obviously just had that trust in your ability. So how important is it to, I guess, overcome our fears and to keep pushing forward?
It's my favorite thing, because I feel like that's where you learn, like challenging ourselves and pushing ourselves to take a chance and do something uncomfortable. I was having a conversation with the previous chief technology officer for Australia and New Zealand, and I said, I don't really want to do it. And he said, isn't that our job? Like, doing things we don't want to do, because that's where we learn and grow. And so it's a really powerful lesson, is how do you step into that fear? And again, it comes back to, I do work through, like, what's the worst that can happen? I fall off the stage during my public speaking. It'll be hilarious. I'll have a great story to tell. Worst case. Best case, I get to talk to a group of people. I get to share some information. I do it well. I do it badly. I learn something in the process. And the next time I do it, I do it better. And so I think it's just, how do you turn everything into that opportunity to learn, which then pivots from fear to learning? Like, how do you make everything a learning opportunity is my big thing.
Yeah, I completely agree. And having that attitude is then you're not afraid to fail, because you go, oh, well, as long as I learn, I fail forward and I just keep on getting up and keep on going. So that attitude is clearly what's got you to where you are today. So I would love to dive in now to your role with Microsoft, because you say the word Microsoft, people must be going, wow, how did you land that job? What did you do? So can you talk us through that journey from joining Microsoft? Because in 8 years, I think you've been there 8 years from like a senior LinkedIn, you've achieved incredible things, and you pretty much got to the top of, you know, there's no higher role in technology that I know of. Maybe there'll be chief of AI or something, there'll be another role created soon, but chief technology officer is massive. So can you tell us how that journey came about and the steps that you took to get to where you are today?
I'll be really honest. I'd never thought about a job in technology. I was working in telecommunications at the time, and a colleague I'd worked with in telecommunications was working at Microsoft. She's like, you just have to come and work here. It's amazing. Come and work with us. And I was on maternity leave. It was the perfect storm of no. I was on maternity leave. I had a job I loved in telecommunications. I was like, I am so happy. I don't need this. And she somehow convinced me to have just a conversation with her boss. And it was funny. I was sitting in the foyer of the Microsoft office waiting for this conversation. And there was a video playing about all of philanthropic things that Microsoft does. And I was like, oh, I want to work here. This is cool. And so I think I talked about that land and expand approach. It's what I did at Microsoft. I started with a role that I knew I could do standing on my head. And so I started off as what we call a pursuit lead. It's basically tender management. And to me, tender management is super easy. It's really logical. You just follow the steps through and you do what the customer's asking for. I find it really easy. But I don't love that job. I'm really good at it. And it's a piece of advice I often talk to people about is just because you're good at something doesn't mean you should always do it, but I use it as a technique for opening a door. And so doing that job exposed me to so many different roles that I could then work out where I really wanted to be. And so from there, I sort of navigated different roles across Microsoft. And this role wasn't my end goal. In fact, I had no idea about this role as I started that journey. But over time, I saw that this was the thing I love. And I think until I started at Microsoft, I hadn't done anything with technology. It's genuine. So I've had 8 years to learn technology. And I'm working with people who've been doing this for a lifetime, who have 20 to 30 years experience in this space. And that can be really daunting, standing up next to them, talking about complex things like quantum or artificial intelligence. But I think when you love something so deeply, you learn. Like, it's really easy to learn and step into that. It's been that land and expand. I've learned to understand what I'm really good at and where I shine and try and find roles where I can do those things and then match against that, my must-haves. So in my time at Microsoft, I won't call it a misstep. I chose a role that didn't have customer-facing opportunities. And it turns out I love talking to customers. And so that's something I've learned over the time and trying to find then another role that enabled me to get back with customers and spend time with them rather than inside the business. So for me, it's just about learning what are my must-haves, what are my skills, my superpowers, and how do I match those into a job that then becomes self-fulfilling. You become successful if you love it and it matches the skills you have.
Yeah, that is actually such powerful advice, because what I think people tend to do is they go into a business and they think, why aren't I CTO in a year? And what you've done is you've gone in and you've built up your knowledge bucket first, and you've gone in and you've got really good at something, and then I'm sure been noticed. Yes. Hey, Sarah's really good at that. Been visible. Let's put her over here. Got really good at it. Hey, Sarah's really good at that. And not afraid to go in at maybe a slightly lower level role. Yes. And work your way up through the business, accumulating all of the skills and continuously to grow. I think from what I'm seeing a lot of where people go wrong is they constantly jump ship because there's this shiny object over here. Come over here. You're going to be the managing partner of this or the CTO of that. But what they've not done is build up their knowledge bucket of skills first and foremost. And what I'm hearing from you is that's what you did. You were constantly seeking to learn and grow throughout the job. And then naturally, because you got really good at something, you just progressed up the career ladder. Would you say that's quite accurate?
It is. And I love what you touched on there, because I think often we have in our heads what the next job should be. And often we're thinking it has to be up as opposed to what might be perceived as sideways. And I think often when you move sideways, maybe doing something similar or in a different team, we forget how much you learn in that moment. And so I like to think about what are the skills gaps or experience gaps that I have, because that's in how I map out what might come next. Because then instead of thinking like, okay, well, I have to have a bigger job. I need to be a director. I need to be a general manager. I need to be a corporate vice president. Instead of that, I'm thinking about, okay, well, I don't know a lot about policy. So I need to find a role that helps me tap into that. And that then helps me grow because I'm learning something new. And as you said, you get noticed and people find you. And I think that's a powerful thing as well is, don't underestimate who might see you in any given moment. Don't want to put pressure on people. But the role before this one that I was doing at Microsoft was 100% because the manager of that team saw me in a session we were doing, and it wasn't a session of me talking about technology or anything like that. She just saw me and went, oh, I want that person in my team. And so, yeah, I think the taking opportunities, doing different things and stepping outside of just the job you do, I think people get stuck in this is my job and this is what I have to focus on. And I like to meet other people in the business. So how you expand your network.
Again, this is so powerful. Everything you're saying is stuff that I find myself repeating over again. It's really refreshing having somebody say it who's actually walked the talk as well, who's done it and done it this way. Because you also said another word there, networking, and networking around the business and meeting people and getting known within the organization. But I love what you said as well, Sarah, about these sideways steps. What are my skill gaps? What else do I need to learn? How can I, that department, I need to learn more about process. So I'm going to go over there. It's like we don't just have to just feel like we're constantly working our way up. Actually, sometimes we need a sidestep to then make a bigger jump towards the end. But taking on this CTO role now at Microsoft. So again, I'm just coming back to this because it's an incredible role. And so I'm sure there's a lot of people listening to this right now going, how did she do it? Like, how did that come about? Was the role sort of advertised, or were you tapped on the shoulder? Like, how did that role come about for you?
Yeah, so it was advertised. And obviously Microsoft, we like to try and support internal talent. So there is an element to that, which is I was very targeted in this. I knew the person who held the role before me. I knew the team that surrounded them, and I made sure that they knew who I was as well. Because I think it's really naive of us to think that a job comes up and we apply for it and we stand a chance when there are hundreds and hundreds of people applying for that. If the manager who owns that role doesn't know who you are, if the team around you, around that person, doesn't know who you are. So, you know, coming back to that networking piece, it's a formula for me. I'm like, which job looks interesting? I like that job. All right, now I'm going to meet all the people around that role so that if that ever comes up, they will think of me. And I suppose in a way it's me buying my way into the interview process. It doesn't guarantee an interview. It doesn't guarantee that you'll get the job, but it means at least that the door is more open for you than perhaps someone who's coming in cold. And so that's what happened, the CTO role. I spent a lot of time working really closely with the previous person and made sure that everyone knew, including my existing manager, that that was the role that I was looking at long term. I never expected it to be quite so soon, so let's be clear about that. This is like a long term plan. But I think that's the other thing, is that we always have these perfect plans, and nothing's ever perfect. There's never a good time. You know, I talked about joining Microsoft when I had a 5-month-old and a job I love. Like, there's never a good time. So it's just making a plan, but being prepared for the fact that there's never a good time for these things. And sometimes you're just going to have to jump.
And jump you did. So congratulations, because yeah, huge role and such a great brand. And like I said, your CV would be very impressive. But like, I'd love to know, because I always think this, I love to like look behind the doors, and I'd love to sort of like shadow people in these, you know, big technology roles. But what does a typical day look like for you, typical week? Are you do more management, more leadership? Like what are you sort of doing day to day?
I think there's no such thing as typical in this job, which is why I love it. Day and week is so different, which is, I think, part of, you know, we talked about what do you love, what do you need. I am someone who gets bored really easily, and I don't do well with repetition. So this is the perfect role for me. And I spend my time probably spread across a couple of different activities. So a lot of what I do is public presentation. So whether that's conferences, podcasts, media sessions, something like that. So some portion of my week is dedicated to that. So this week I've got 2 conferences that I'm speaking at. I spend a lot of time with customers, and I love listening to their challenges. So it's not me talking at them. I like having a conversation with customers. And that's part of how I get across what's happening in industries, what trends are, what's happening in the market. Often they ask me to look into my crystal ball and tell them what comes next, which is always fun. But yeah, so a lot of time spent with customers, and then I spend a lot of time learning, because I can't do those first 2 things if I'm not up to date with what's happening in the industry, or I haven't thought about all that information I'm getting in and what that means for the industry. And so, you know, I do quite a bit of thought leadership. So preparing papers, content, whether that's for internal briefings or external briefings. And then, of course, there's a whole lot of technical troubleshooting, things that haven't gone quite right, customers that are stuck for whatever reason. You know, at the moment, a lot of it is generative AI. And quite hearteningly, I think the thing they're challenged with is, how do we do this responsibly? And so that's a lot of the work I'm doing at the moment, is how do we help our customers step into this space in a responsible way? How do we help them unblock that?
It's a very interesting period. And I do think that we're seeing more change. Well, I don't think, I know, we're seeing more change in the every single day than I've probably seen in my entire lifetime. It's just the pace is just quite insane. What advice? Okay, so again, you're sort of speaking on the topic of AI. I get so many mixed messages coming at me. Like some people, some podcasts I listen to is, it's doom and gloom. This is the end of humanity as we know it. Other podcasts I listen to go, oh, this is the future. We need to embrace it. This is fantastic. Where do you sit with it all? Because there's a lot of people also listen to this podcast that are fearful of the future. They're fearful for their jobs. They're fearful of their children's jobs. What's your thoughts on AI?
I am a deeply positive person in the first place. So I have to temper that with some negativity sometimes. But I can see the vast potential that AI offers us as a society if we can get it right. And I look at the way it enables people who've been marginalized from technology to fully participate. Like, you think about chatbots are a really good example. We've all chatted with a chatbot, and if you don't get the question just right, you get no answers or bad answers, whereas generative AI understands your context. So if I can't spell or I don't know how to ask the question properly, it can interpret that in a way that chatbots couldn't. So it opens up services, opportunities, technology for people who couldn't participate previously. And I often talk about my son and his learning challenges, and I've seen what generative AI does for students who normally get left behind and how it helps them actually be part of that full learning experience again. And I've seen how it can diagnose things faster and enable deeply personalized treatment plans for people who are sick. So I can see that huge potential on side of things, but I can also see the potential for unintended consequences. And I often use the example of that we can all relate to, I think, is check-in at the airports. So, you know, they went from having a counter where people would help and do all the process for you, where it's now automated. And I travel a lot, and I see these people who don't have a smartphone, who may be traveling for the first time in a long time, who can't check in. And they're already in a really stressful moment because they're traveling. And now they can't actually access or participate or do the thing they needed to do. And I think that's an unintended consequence of this automation that was brought in. And so if we think about AI, I think that's the thing we need to be conscious of, is who do we marginalize if we bring this in? What are the unintended consequences of large-scale AI? But at the core of it, I think people often dramatize this. We talk about how, you know, the AI is going to kill us. It's going to take all our jobs. This is a story that we tell ourselves. But fundamentally, it's being created by humans, and that gives me heart, because we are the ones who have it in our control to use it, to think about it, to introduce it. It's not some random automation happening off on the side. It's us. And so that human element is really critical. But I think the thing that heartens me the most is I'm talking to a lot of customers and government agencies who are looking at how they do this. And the number one question they're asking at the moment is, how do we do it responsibly? How do we build an AI framework so we are considering these unintended consequences? How are we mindful about its use? And so that gives me a lot of heart that people aren't just deploying it willy-nilly and hoping for the best.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I'm a really positive person as well, and I always have my cup full, not empty. But what you just said then about the airport, such a prime example, because I've had my mum out from the UK for the last couple of months, and she's flying back to the UK soon, and she wants everything printed off. And I'm like, mum, everything's on your phone and your email. She's like, no, Georgina, I need it printed off. And I was just like, and it's just, as you said that, I thought of her, because it's like, again, it's like, she's so so young still. She's in her 60s, but already this technology, like you say, is advanced so much. And over the next 5-10 years, it's going to advance even more. And it's like making sure that we don't lose that generation, or they can't do the things that they do every day, or it becomes harder for them, not easier for them. Because even like I look at the younger generation now, they're so quick on their phones. And I think, God, you know, at your age, I didn't know what a phone was, you know? Yeah. And I also reflect back quite fondly, Sarah, on my own childhood. And I think this is where the blurred lines comes in, because on one hand, I know technology is going to be a big part in this, in young people's future. On the other hand, I want to protect them as long as possible from social media platforms and things like that. So where do you sort of blend this between giving your children, you know, the technology that you know is going to be part of their lives, but also trying to have some sort of boundaries with it as well?
Yeah, it's such a great question. Of course, I battle this with my son who, growing up in this household full of technology, is use it all the time. And I, like you, have that childhood where I remember climbing trees and building forts and things like that. And so how do you find that balance? I try and find the things where it is a genuine asset. So teaching him skills or understanding or enablement versus just using the tech because it's there. And so, you know, you think about gaming. Gaming can teach you really important skills if it's the right kind of game that you're playing, versus just gaming because it's a mindless thing to do for a really long period of time. I must say, I love gaming, so that's not it. So I'm blaming, I can spend hours doing it. But for my son, I'm very, very strict. Like, he has very tight parameters when he's allowed to use technology and when he's not, because I want him to build the critical thinking that will ensure that he has a job into the future. And I think that's the thing we forget about, is technology can be deployed across all of these things, but the two things that I see that make us human, that enable us to have these jobs into the future, are critical thinking. You know, we've heard about how AI can hallucinate. Well, the solution to that is your ability to actually assess whether what it's saying is right or wrong. Like, your critical thinking is the thing that becomes important. And the second one is creativity. So I'm very big on, my poor son is made to draw and craft and do all those sort of things, because that creativity is critical to being able to think around problems. And so critical thinking and creativity for me are the two skills that I try and amplify alongside the use of technology.
Yeah, I think it's just really important to find that balance. But again, I don't think it needs to be restricted. I think, like you said, then it's just like, what's going to help your son evolve and grow and develop his skills, versus, you know, what's just a video game where it's just shooting people in the street. Like, we're not learning anything from that. And they're the ones that I think we need to be protected from. But going on to young people now, because this is something we were just touch upon before we jumped on. As I said, I'm very passionate about the younger generation coming up, especially when it comes to young girls and women, because technology in the past, I think, has been seen as an industry where, oh, it's for boys in hoodies and basements. It's not for me. It's and even as I, if I reflect on my younger years, it was teacher, nurse, social worker, beautician. Technology didn't even come into it. Luckily, we're starting to see some change, but not quite at the pace I'd like to see. So what advice would you have for even like younger people or parents out there that want to make sure that their children, if they've got young girls, are interested in technology, and any ideas that you have that we could try and encourage more girls to have an interest in it?
That is such a complex question, and I wish there was some silver bullet, because there are so many levels and layers to how we fundamentally shift things to get balance back into the industry. The thing I'm probably most focused on at the moment, because it's an easy one for us to do at scale, is trying to help people see the different roles available in the industry, because you talked about their, you know, the coders in their hoodies. And there is this perception that tech requires this software coding skill. And if you think about it, you know, it's the first set of subjects we teach as part of degrees and tech courses. Even if you're never going to use it, you have to do these coding units at university as part of an IT degree. And so I think the industry is so vast, and that coding is just one small subset of it. And I would love for us to amplify just that variety of roles. And as you said, I think as children, we are so blinkered, because we only see those really standard, easy to understand roles, like lawyers and doctors and nurses and teachers and things that are really easy to define, versus these roles that are more complex or harder to put a pin in. Like, no kid goes out there and says, I want to be a bid manager when I grow up. That's not a thing. But it is. And that's the thing. I think this is a challenge, is that we don't share this breadth of craziness of roles out there across all industries. But for tech, that I think is the opportunity to really unlock it, that there is this perception it is deeply technical, coding only, versus all the skills that are needed in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. And even your journey is so inspiring because you didn't come from a technical background. And this is why I do the podcast, because people think I've got to go to university, got to have a tech degree, got to do this, got to do that. And then I'm going to, you know, be a great coder, then I'll be a CTO. And that, if I'm honest, when I first got into technology recruitment, that's what I thought. I thought you have to have that technology background to really get ahead, and you're walking, talking proof of you don't. But what you do have, Sarah, is very clear communication skills, that problem solving attitude, that curiosity, adaptability. And you've naturally just sort of, I don't know, had this ability about you to sort of see problems, or just you look at things from this really good lens. And I think that this, so far in this podcast, there's going to be some real nuggets of gold that people go, ah, okay, I'm starting to understand now how people try and get up to these big roles, because they do these certain patterns, and I'm looking for patterns constantly. And there's just been a few things that you've said that have really stood out to me. So yeah, again, this is why I do this podcast, because not everyone's career journey is just following this linear path. It's a bit of a zigzag to get to where you've got to. It's really good.
Definitely. Sorry. And you were talking about like how do you do this? And I can't believe I'm about to promote. I've been reading a book by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, people. My God. I love Arnie. Love him.
I read it because I was like, really? What do you have to say that I would be interested in? But the book is called Be Useful. And he actually talks about in that there will always be people who are smarter than you or more naturally talented, but there is nothing that will beat hard work. And that's the thing that I think, you know, everyone's like, oh, what's the secret formula? How did you do it? I work hard.
Yeah.
I'm not naturally good at these things. I have to go and learn them. But I work hard. And that's the thing I think is really important, is we often forget these things don't happen naturally. You have to work for them. But I just love that piece in his book, which is, you know, there will always be people who are better at these things than you are, but nothing will ever beat hard work. And that will always win out.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. I wanted to quickly pop in and talk to you about our amazing supporter, CH Talent Solutions. We are an IT and digital recruitment company based in Australia. If you are someone right now looking for a new opportunity or considering a career pivot, please reach out to one of our consultants. Or if you are somebody looking to build your team or build your company or scale, again, please reach out to us if you are looking to find the best tech talent fast. I look forward to connecting with you. Now back to today's episode. Enjoy. I completely agree. And it's the same for every single industry. I've always been the most hardest working person in the room. And, you know, even like when I used to work at the old recruitment company, they used to send around our call sheets at the end of each week. And I was always the one that made the most calls. And then naturally, I was the one that was doing the most placements. And I was like, it's not, like you said, there's no quick fix. There's no like, I'm not, it's pretty obvious. You know, you do generally need to work hard. And okay, again, so this sort of leads me on really beautifully to something that I did want to touch upon. So you say work hard, but it's also working smart. And there's a lot of talk at the minute around quiet quitting and burnout and people feeling completely overwhelmed. So how do you, in your, you know, you're traveling a lot, you've got a young child at home, how do you make sure that you're still making time for you, Sarah, to look after yourself and to keep yourself in balance, if there's a such thing in your own life?
There is. And it's something I do really consciously. And I don't think we talk about it enough. So I love that we're talking about this because I probably didn't do it well for decades. And this is is a relatively new thing for me, being actually conscious about it and giving myself permission to say no to things. In fact, I was talking with my husband over the weekend. I said, I'm reaching capacity and this is the thing I want to say no to. And he's like, oh yeah, but look at the benefits of that. Maybe what else could you say no to instead? And so actually having active conversations about what I'm going to put to one side and being okay with that, knowing that it's not forever, knowing that it may be just for this period of time, and trying to find that the thing that will give me more capacity to do other things. The other thing I do really actively is I talk about the margins. Like, I'm always amazed by how much you can do with 15 minutes if you give yourself, like, I'm going to do this for just 15 minutes. And I often use that for my too hard basket. We've all got it. The things that you just don't want to do that you've put off for ages and ages. We recently moved house. That's why you can see piles of boxes behind me. And so building furniture has been in my too hard basket. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to do 15 minutes a day to build a desk. And it was amazing how quickly the desk actually got built once I just was like, set yourself a thing and do just 15 minutes on it. So using margins, those moments between feeding the child and telling him to get dressed, I'm like, right, cool, I've got 15 minutes. What am I going to do with it? And so I find that really actually gives me more capacity because I'm using all that time consciously rather than sitting there going, oh, okay, cool, what shall I do next? No, focus. What is it? How do I use this margin? How do I use these minutes? But I also draw lines around things. And I did this, I had a couple of teams at Microsoft where I would send out at the start of the year a note that says, between 5 and 7, you can't call me. I will not answer the phone. I have drawn a line around that, and that is family time. And I like to work early, but I don't expect you to respond. I love getting up at 5 o'clock and just smashing through my email so I start the day completely clean. Like, these are my personal work parameters. And so setting those and being clear, whether it's with your team, your manager, in this case, it was a group I was managing, so they could then feel open to do that with me as well and tell me what their preference was. How do they want to be communicated with, and how do they want to run their lives so that I can support that? Those are the things that I do to try and create that balance for myself.
That's fantastic. And I think that protecting that sort of family time is so important, because again, it's like, comes down to our values and making sure, you know, you don't want to get to the end of your life and going, God, look at all, everything I achieved in my career, but my son doesn't talk to me, and, you know, my marriage is, you know, not good. So these are the things that we need to prioritize. And I can imagine that you've got a lot of people coming at you every day wanting things. So just setting those boundaries and those hard no's, go, between this hour and this hour, you cannot contact me, which also sort of makes me think about the current climate that we're living in, where there's this big debate between hybrid, back to office, and all of this going on right now. And look, I think hybrid is fantastic. I'm a big believer that if you give people the autonomy and the trust, they will get the job done. But on the flip side, there's another camp that say, well, you know, we feel like productivity's dipped and, you know, we're losing our culture. It's a very complex issue at the minute, and I'm hearing lots of different things. What's your take, and how do you personally work at Microsoft?
So Microsoft works completely flexibly. So I personally do the majority of my work from home. The teams that I work with are in completely different places. So me being in an office doesn't offer anything in terms of that connection in a meeting sense, but it offers connection with people because it's a nice thing to meet people and not just be sitting in a room looking at a screen all day. So I do periodically go into the office. But that question you're asking, and I think it's really interesting, organizations keep talking about the fact that productivity is dipped. My challenge to them would be is, how are you measuring productivity? Because we often feel like if we aren't in meetings, we're not being productive, or if we aren't getting lots of emails, we aren't being productive. And I think people need to consider how they're actually measuring what productivity really is for their organization. Because I think people are more productive from home. They're happier in that hybrid scenario where they get to make a choice, where they get to quickly throw a load of washing on or sit outside in their garden for 10 minutes. Like, those things make people happier, and therefore they will stay with organizations longer if they have that flexibility. So I'm a big advocate for the hybrid, because I think it does more for your people if you trust them, as you said. If you trust that they're going to do the things they need to do, you'll get so much more from them.
I completely agree. And I love the fact that you're working for such a big company and you're working from home as well. And I think that a lot of people, smaller businesses, will look to companies like Microsoft to say, well, what are they doing? What are they doing? But it sounds like you've got a very forward-thinking mentality around the ways of working, which is probably why, after, I don't know, so many years, decades, that Microsoft is still a leader in this space, in the technology space. And I always think that, I say it before, success leaves clues, and there's reasons why these companies stand the test of time, is because they're the first to innovate, they look after their people, and there are, again, patterns in business as well. So you've been there 8 years now. What are some examples that you think Microsoft does do well as a company, as a brand, to set their people up for success and continue to innovate and continue to be a market leader in technology?
I love your perspective on that because it's so interesting when you look at Microsoft at its history. There is this period of time from the early 2000s to around 2014 when we probably weren't growing and innovating the way we are now. And we're a bit of an anomaly as far as tech goes. We've never really failed. But there's probably this period of time where we just weren't innovating like we wanted to be. And part of that was culture. And that's a fundamental shift I've actually had the opportunity to live through over the last 8 years. So in 2015, we embarked on this huge journey of changing the culture of Microsoft. And it is the one thing that I think underpins Zen success more holistically. So we used to have a reward system that stack ranked every person in a team from 1 through to 5. And people at the bottom, that was it. See you later. Thanks very much. It's the most terrible reward system because, of course, everyone is then out for the individual, for themselves, because I don't want to be the bottom of that stack. And so it created this culture of infighting constantly within teams, across teams. And so this culture shift we moved to changed how we reward people. And we have what we call 3 circles of impact. And so we now reward people based on how successful they are individually, one circle. One circle is how are they building on the ideas of others? So how are they reusing what somebody else has done rather than claiming greatness for reinventing the wheel? And then the 3rd circle is how are they helping other people be successful? And I love that it now looks at all, like, how are you helping other people and building on their ideas as well as how great you are as an individual? So those 3 circles are weighted evenly, and that's how we reward people. The 2nd piece that I think Microsoft has done really well over the last 8-9 years is a growth mindset. So I came into Microsoft and I was like, why are we sitting under trees and humming and talking about how good it is to learn stuff? Like, really? And now you couldn't find a bigger advocate for growth mindset. Like, I love the way it talks to you having this learner mindset. You know, we don't know everything and we want to constantly ask questions and learn and grow. And you've seen that. There's this wonderful graphic that shows the share price from, the 1990s through to 2014. It's completely flat. And 2014 is when we started that culture change, and the share price completely changes because innovation suddenly became part of our culture again. And we were amplifying it. We were rewarding people for it. We were talking about it, and we were trying to learn more and more and more. And so I'm a big advocate for, the impact culture change can have on innovation and success. And I think that's what you've seen in Microsoft in the time I've been with them.
Well, thank you for taking us behind the scenes there, because again, a lot of people would have a question mark on how did they do that? And again, it goes back to people and that people first. And as soon as they flipped that and got better, that better culture, everything changed. And I don't think that people, again, I'm in recruitment, so I'm biased, but it's like, put your people first. And it's like, this is such an important piece to get right. And I'm also a big believer of culture add versus culture fit as well. I think that when you're constantly hiring for people to fit in, you're not getting that diversity of thought. So again, diversity, inclusion, huge talking point right now, but how, especially in your team as well, what do you look for when you're building out your team and the people around you? And how important is that diversity of thought when it comes to innovation?
You have actually just, you could have been reading from the Microsoft playbook there. That was culture add versus is exactly what we talk about. And it's the challenge we have for ourselves. We have a series of questions that we are supposed to ask ourselves as hiring managers. And it is like, what does this person bring that is different to what we have right now? How does this person add to the team? And it's often an interview question. Like, what will you add to this team? What will you bring? Because we don't want the same thing, because we don't want the same perspectives, because that's how you get into that group thing. And everyone thinks they're doing the same. Come on, we're amazing. We're all thinking the same. So you could have just been reading from our playbook. That is exactly what we think about. Diversity is so critical to how we build our business. And it's challenging. I don't want to make it think people think this is really easy. It's really hard, but it's good hard. You finding people who challenge you every day and being okay with that, because we naturally don't like that, that's really good for you, because it makes you stop and think. And it doesn't mean you have to agree with them. It doesn't mean that you always have to agree in a meeting. But if you've got those voices speaking up, it means that you may actually get something better or right, or something that actually addresses a real need versus the thing you thought it needed to be.
Yeah. And I promise you, I wasn't reading from it. It's just something I've always sort of thought naturally. I'm like, you know, when people say, oh, he wasn't the right culture fit. And I just go, well, why do you want people just to fit in? Like, I've never really understood that. I've always asked, again, I think I'm quite curious by nature. I'm like, can you just explain what you mean by that? Because it's such a cop out when someone says he or she just wasn't the right culture fit. I'm like, I don't understand what you mean by that. Can you elaborate? And normally it's because we go for beers on a Friday. We're not sure how this person's going to, you know, and it's like, come on, we need to change this sort of thoughts. And gratefully, it's changed a lot. I've been doing this for 10 years now. I think when I first started my recruitment career in tech, I think I could probably count on one hand the amount of females I placed and the amount of females I was placing into sort of leadership roles. So gratefully, it's changed a lot. But look, there's no denying, Sarah, that you've had an incredible career. And there's a reason why I've called this podcast Career Confidence, because I do believe that is a very, very big, it's a good foundation that a lot of other things are built upon. So in your personal opinion, how important do you think that sort of confidence, that belief in yourself is? And on top of that, how have you personally gone about growing your own confidence and self-belief?
Yeah. Confidence is different for everyone. I think we often say, oh, you have to have confidence. And as if it's like a singular thing, it's a spectrum. And you've got to find the place that you're comfortable with. I said before, the phrase I say a lot is, what's the worst that could happen? I have a really good imagination, so I can come up with some horrifying worst case scenarios for things. But I have found that making myself do those things that I don't want to do is the best way to build back confidence. Because if I step in and I do something that's a little bit hard, the next time I have to do a hard thing or an uncomfortable thing, I know I can do it because I've done it once before. I've done something similar, and it builds that resilience to me. And for me, that's confidence. And, you know, I go through all of those worst case scenarios. And if I've thought about them, then I'm like, okay, well, if it happens, I know what to do. Or it's not unexpected. I've worked through it. And so that's how I've built confidence. But it's hard and it's not perfect. You know, I had a situation just recently which really knocked me around. And I've just had to tell myself to put my big girl pants on and just step into it. That situation sucked and totally got it wrong. But sitting around and licking my wounds isn't going to help me get better or grow from it. So I just have to step back into the space and do it again. So sometimes the worst thing can happen, and you just have to, as we said before, learn from it and just take that forward.
Exactly. And because you'd already stacked up the evidence beforehand, you had that sort of baseline. But I'm also just thinking, if somebody had just stepped up to do something really challenging and felt like they'd failed straight away, any advice for that person that maybe has done what you've done, but doesn't have the evidence to support them that, oh, this is just a blip, this is just a one-off, and, you know, move on, it, you know, it's happened now. Any advice to people that are trying to build up their confidence but just keep on getting knocked down?
Yeah, like I think if it happens more than once, if the same thing keeps happening, I always stop and think about, why is that? Like, what's the root cause of that thing? And sometimes it can be really hard and confronting. You're like, oh, maybe I'm not really good at public speaking. Maybe that's a thing I shouldn't do. Or maybe I need to go away and learn something else, or get exposure in a different scenario so I can build the skill to take it back to that other scenario. You know, talking to media is a really special skill because they make you feel like you're friends and you'll share things you shouldn't share. And so, you know, how do you build that skill in a safe way so then you can take it to a place where you can then do it again? But if it's happened, if you've taken that chance and it didn't go to plan, you've got to look for the positives in it, which is you actually tried in the first place. And to me, that's all you can do is try, like step up and try. Because how many people didn't step up and take that opportunity or step up and try that thing? And so I think you need to take confidence in the fact that you actually did it. Like that, it's a really, sounds really naff, but to me that is so critical, is how many people didn't and you did. So own that and be okay with that. Like, yeah, I tried it and it actually didn't go to plan, but at least I tried it. And take that little piece of confidence out of that.
100%. One of the best books I read was a book by Brené Brown, Daring Greatly. And she was also, she talks about obviously being in the arena. And if you're not in the arena, then, you know, I'm not going to listen to you. And I think anyone that's in the arena, we all cheerlead each other. And if I see somebody doing something, I am just like, yes, yes, amazing, amazing. Because I know that what it's taken to get to that point and the confidence and everything else that you have to get there. But, you know, if you're not in the arena, I'm not going to listen to your opinion because you're not doing it. You know, I'm doing it. I'm here and I want the support of other people in the arena. But yeah, I think it's, again, that daring greatly, and we're not going to get it right the first time, but we're going to learn and we're going to experience it. And that's how we grow. And that's how we build confidence. I said it before. It's like putting ourselves in a comfortable position, having the courage to do it. Confidence comes from that. So I loved that you just said that. That's fantastic. Sarah, I could talk to you all day, but I'm conscious that you are a very, very busy woman. You've got a pretty big role there. But look, what's next for you? Like, what would you like to achieve? And I was like, you know, do you have any goals that you want to achieve in the next sort of like couple of years with Microsoft? Or are you just sort of like, you know, just seeing what comes your way?
This is such a great question. Yeah, it's such a great question because I have no idea. Which I think is a great thing. I have no problem not having an idea. And so for me at the moment, I'm thinking about what are my gaps? What are the things I'd love to learn? What experiences do I want to have in order to build towards something? And I don't know what that something might be, but I, you know, for example, I spend a lot of time talking to boards. I'd like to be on some boards to help me be on the other side of it and build a bit of a skill in that. So for me, that's the kind of thing I'm looking at the moment. What are my gaps in experience or learning or knowledge that I need to fill, regardless of whatever might be the next thing, because I have no idea what that might be yet.
I love that. Sarah, for those people that listen to this that want to connect with you, find out more about you, where can I send them?
LinkedIn is the easiest place to find me. I am all over the place there. So feel free to go connect with me and I always answer my messages there. As you know, Georgie.
I do know. That's how I got you. Look, thank you so much for being on this podcast today. I know that me and myself have learned so much and I'm feeling extremely inspired and wanting to sort of go away and reflect and look at my own career. But thank you so much. It's been a fantastic conversation. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you've got this far, that honestly means the world to me and lets me know that you've got a lot of value from today's episode. So if I could just ask you to do one thing, pull out your phone and please leave a quick review. It honestly would mean the world to me. It will help this podcast grow and get our message out there to more people. So if you could do that for me, that would be amazing. And please reach out and just let me know what you want to hear more about, what you're interested in. It will just also help me make sure that I'm continuing to speak to topics that are relevant and also find guests that are real true experts in what you want to know more about. So have an amazing day. Thanks so much for doing that. And I can't wait to share the next episode with you.